So pick something else. And I was like, I don't know. And my sister took me to recitals, you know, like she took me to a tuba recital. And I was like, no. bassoon recital, flute. And I was just not interested. I was more into sports at the time. I was just like, you know, this isn't going to work. I just like playing soccer. This is my thing. I mean, we have my sister.
Well, I think that's probably changed a little bit over the years. I think we are now more a group that will try to speak less at first and not try to work out the minutiae of things from the get-go, but try to get more of a feel for the piece, the bigger picture.
So, in terms of performance, yeah, I do think it's important to find different venues, different audiences, different repertoire, just all different stuff, to just keep things fresh and also to kind of stretch yourself.
Nerves are constantly a part of things, but I've found that we are performing a lot in all sorts of different circumstances, and just the practice of performing is so helpful. The seventh time you play the same piece, the nerves definitely go down. Breathing, jumping around, dancing, and playing the same things a bunch of times, keys to success.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. And today's episode is unusual because four musicians are featured, the members of the Euclid Quartet. They are a world-class string quartet celebrating their 25th anniversary with a fantastic album of short pieces entitled Brev. And we are featuring several pieces from that album as part of this episode. The link that will take you to all the places to listen to and buy this album is right in the description of this episode, along with their website. In this conversation, you'll get to know each member of the quartet, which is in residence at the Indiana University South Bend. Jameson Cooper, violinist and founding member, originally from England, you'll hear about his experience as a student of Dorothy DeLay and Roland and Almida Vamos. He also talked about the formative years of the quartet and the nuts and bolts of learning repertoire. The other violinist in the quartet is Aviva Hakanoglu, who holds degrees from Harvard, Indiana University, and Stony Brook University, and was a student of Philip Zetzer. And it was really interesting to hear about her experience auditioning for the quartet and her perspectives on community outreach and as an educator. Violist Luis Enrique Vargas is a longtime member of the Euclid Quartet and started his life in music in Venezuela at the age of 14 and spoke about introducing Latin American composers to his colleagues. Finally, cellist Justin Goldsmith is the newest member of the quartet. When he was completing his master's degree at Indiana University, he formed the Vera Quartet, which held residencies at both IU and the Curtis Institute of Music, where he was also a community artist fellow. I was curious to learn more about the many roles the quartet plays in their capacities as performers, educators, and collaborators, and to hear them speak about the special joys and challenges of being members of a full-time quartet. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. Finally, before we jump into the episode, I wanted to remind you that this is season four and there are well over 100 episodes you may have missed with a fascinating variety of musicians, and that I'm an independent podcaster who needs the help of my listeners to keep this project going. And the link to buy me a cup of coffee is in the description. Now to the episode. Hi, good morning, Euclid Quartet. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hi.
So you are the first string quartet I've featured on this series, and I'm so glad you could all join me. I think it's very cool. I mean, the string quartet is such an important ensemble and form of music, but not all my listeners will be familiar. Not everyone knows classical music. And I was thinking, you know, when I went to university, I had not experienced string quartets to that point and wasn't familiar with the repertoire. And I remember there was a jazz saxophone player who said, "You don't know the late string quartets of Beethoven, just go immediately to the library and listen to those." And it was so mind-blowing to get exposed to that music. Jameson, you grew up in the UK. I get the impression there's a little more of a culture of chamber music for youth, is that right?
Gosh, I don't know. I wouldn't say so. I mean, I really didn't have an awful lot of chamber music experience myself, and until I got to college, well, it sort of threw together the second movement of the Barber String Quartet once with some buddies, and I was in the National Youth Orchestra in England, and we would always try to have a get together and smash through some things, and it was usually Mendelssohn Octet. Yeah. we tried to put together. I wouldn't really say I had a tremendous amount of chamber music until I got to, I didn't really have an awful lot there either, but it was part of the course, and I certainly got my feet wet a little bit with quartets and trios and things there, but I think there's more infrastructure here in the United States to support that activity, actually, than there is in England. Certainly nowadays, I mean, it's very difficult in England now for classical music. The business itself is dwindling, I think, more rapidly than it is here. So, yeah. Anyway, that said, you know, I certainly listened to the music, and I was interested in it, although I wasn't expecting that would eat up my life, but that's the way it goes.
We're going to talk a lot about education and outreach, which is so important, but let's get into your beautiful album you're just releasing, Brev. And I love these kind of albums with short pieces, and certainly when I was putting together chamber music concerts, I'd always look for a short piece we could kind of add in there to balance things out. So I'm sure you have used these pieces not only as encores, I'm guessing you've also inserted them into programs. Did you guys have a lot of discussion around deciding what to put on this album?
I wouldn't say a great deal. I mean, these pieces have been in and out of our repertoire over the years, so they were sort of naturally selected. We didn't really pick anything new specifically for the album, I don't think. They were all things that had been around before. Maybe I think probably the Mozart Adagio and Fugue was the most recent thing that we picked up. But again, it wasn't just for the album. We had played it before. We've sort of had them functioning sometimes as encores, but very often it was to try to just sort of change out the pace a little bit of a program, especially, you know, if you're doing things like late Beethoven or Bartok 6 or something like that, then people just... okay, let's just have something a little fun there and again, and you know, so we're not too full of ourselves the whole time. I think that they've functioned in a couple different capacities for us over the years, but you know, they're all just pieces that are dear to our hearts, so that we want to give them the same love that we have some of the larger works that we have in albums.
I love to feature music early in an episode so people can hear what you're about. Now, there were a few pieces on here I was not familiar with. Javier Alvarez wrote this Metro Tabacano. Luis, you were telling me earlier you had introduced the quartet to this piece.
Yeah, so I had a string quartet before I joined the Euclid Quartet. So it goes back to the time I was in Venezuela. And we applied to several music festivals in the United States and also in Mexico, and we actually ended up coming to the U.S. to the Roundtop Festival. I'm not going to say the year because that was many years ago. So. But then we went to San Miguel de Allende and also Morelia, Michoacán, that year. So we were introduced, this piece was introduced to us by the Cuarteto Latinoamericano, and we got very excited about it, and then they suggested we learn it. So we actually worked with the couple of the members of the quartet, and we really liked it. So it's a piece that it was originally composed to accompany a kinetic installation at a subway station. That's what metro means, metro. And there is actually a subway station, Metro Chabacano. I had to go to that one. When I was in Mexico City, I actually went to that station just to look at it. But you hear it in the music. It's very much... well, like that, like it's kinetic, you know, there's so much motion going on, and it's a little unrelenting, but very, very interesting. Very short piece that it's there's a lot of motion in it. So I introduced that piece to my colleagues, as well as a couple other Latin American pieces that we wanted to consider in our rep. So
you're about to hear Metro Chabacano by Javier Alvarez, who was one of Mexico's most important composers. He died in 2023 at the age of 67. All the tracks featured in this podcast are from the Euclid Quartet's album Brev, and you will find all the buying and streaming links at the link in the description. Wonderful. Thanks. I wanted to ask about this American Masterpieces grant that you guys received way back in 2009. So I'm guessing Jameson and Luis, you were in the quartet at that time.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems to me you guys were a little bit on the leading edge of awareness of representation and diversity in the music you're presenting and outreach with schools.
Well, it was something we were sort of doing without any particular sociological intent behind it. We had pieces that we happened to be playing that we had a friend who was Puerto Rican, and we enjoyed playing his music, and we had this piece by Jennifer Higdon, and so we had a quite a cross section of American composers that we had played and that happened to, you know, come from various backgrounds and different parts of society and stuff. So we realized when we were looking into making these school programs that, hey, we have something here where, you know, this is all American music, but it sort of shows the broad spectrum of what it means to be an American, you know. So we had Asian American and Latino and African American, and we just had a nice sort of cross section of music. And I think we only actually needed to find a couple of other pieces to put in that program to feel like we'd represented, you know, as many different facets as we could think of. So it sort of naturally suggested itself when we were thinking about this idea of the educational program that would not only introduce people to great music, but also, you know, have kids thinking a little bit more about identity and how that's represented in music. So it was definitely a fun project to do. We built a robot, well, a fake robot. It looked like a robot that spoke to the kids, and they were quizzed on different things, and it was just a really fun and different endeavor for us at the time. And it just turned out that, yeah, a few years later, people were definitely thinking more along these lines in terms of programming for adults and, you know, incorporating this music more regularly into concert programs than perhaps had been before.
It was interesting when I was looking at what you guys do, thinking about what the career of a string quartet can look like. Because I think that it was never, even when there were maybe more chamber music series and programs, I'm not sure how things have really changed, but I'm guessing there were never that many string quartets that could really make a living by performing and recording. So you guys do so many things, and a lot of it does involve education. Justin, could you speak to that a little bit? I know you had background when you were at Curtis, you did this outreach as part of that.
Sure. Yeah, I think the sort of well-trod path for a long time for quartets was to just tour and record, and that was kind of it. You know, there was musicians always teach, right? But there were and are still very few like faculty residencies for full string quartets. So, you know, I think we're pretty lucky to be filling one of those positions at IUSB. And, you know, I think quartets in you know, 2024 have to do a lot of different things in order to make it work. I think there are still those very, very few groups who are able to, you know, make their entire career out of touring and recording. But even they, you know, even those groups, I think, have teaching responsibilities and, you know, do a lot of other things. So I think it's a good thing for quartets to be versatile. I think it's a good thing that the industry has forced quartets to be versatile. And I think it's just really important to, as an individual and as a group, be able to adapt to any kind of situation that you find yourself in, whether it's, you know, teaching, performing in some unconventional space, doing specifically outreach work, you know, all of that kind of stuff. There's just so much that goes into what you do as a quartet that you have to be very ready for anything.
I've noticed, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and certainly when I was in school, no one talked about outreach or playing in unconventional settings. And I've noticed a lot of institutions now are encouraging students. They have specific programs. So Justin, you were involved with this thing at Curtis, right? This fellowship. Do you want to speak to that experience? Maybe a memorable experience through that?
Sure. I think one of the most memorable things that I did during those 2 years was this huge citywide project in Philly called Rehearsing Philadelphia. It was put in the brainchild of Ari Benjamin Myers, composer and sound artist, and the scope of the project was actually enormous. I was involved in a couple of the modules, as they were called. And what we did was go to a gallery in town and set up ensembles that played like durational performances. So it was like 4 hours of music happening in the space, and people could just walk through. And, you know, there were some people playing Bach in a corner of the gallery, you know, then there were some people like playing a piano violin duet somewhere else in the gallery. And then at certain points we would all come together and do something like, clapping music by Steve Reich. You know, it was kind of a planned but unplanned, musical journey for whoever wanted to walk through the space. And I really enjoyed that. I think that sort of programming is still like unfamiliar for me, but really, really interesting to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of certainly a few things like that happening here in my city. It's, you know, we always need to find new audiences, I think. And there's so many people who will love this music, but they just don't know it yet. Well, you know, I really love Wolf's Italian Serenade, and maybe we'll just play a clip of it because it's a little long, but I love this piece. I've played it. So Aviva, was that a piece you'd played before you joined the quartet?
Nope. I had never played that one before. Definitely a challenge. Yeah. It's really, technically demanding for everyone. Obviously the first violin is probably the most in the stratosphere, but the second violin definitely gets its licks. So yeah, that was definitely a tricky one for me to just jump in and kind of get in the fingers and get comfortable with. That's one of the things that recording really brings to light. It's never comfortable to, you know, live perform, but recording just really, it's a mental journey, and if you're not already comfortable, really comfortable with the music you're recording, it can be quite the experience.
This is an excerpt from Hugo Wolf's Italian Serenade. I'm curious, in terms of your rehearsal process, do you guys record yourselves often to hear back, or is that just crazy making?
We should yes. Do it more than we do.
We used to do more of that, actually.
Yeah. But. I think it can be brutal, but it's just a very fast track toward one that we should use more.
So Justin, if I could ask, I'm curious, because with the use of iPads now, do you guys ever read off the score just to make it easier to figure it out?
Yeah, definitely. Both on the iPad and off. You know, the quartet over the years, I've actually been in the group for even less time than Aviva, but the quartet over the years has put together a pretty large library of physical parts and scores. So we have those at our disposal. We can still go and reference them. And yes, we do all actually have tablets now, which is great. Using the tablets and physical parts, it's all, you know, helpful for the rehearsal process.
Yeah, I was just thinking because, you know, in the old days before we had that, to read off a score, there's just so many page turns. But if you're using a foot pedal, it makes it more practical in terms of figuring it out, just seeing it.
Absolutely. I think, Aviva, I think sometimes you read off of a score, right? I think you may be the only one of us that does that.
So Jameson, you were part of the quartet since the beginning.
Yes.
And I was curious if you want to talk to some of those early days, like you guys had a residency at Aspen or any of those formative experiences, how they impacted the quartet.
Sure. The quartet began as a graduate string quartet at Kent State University in Ohio. And we were there from 1998 through 2001, when it actually became the Euclid Quartet. And during that time at the school there, we entered a couple of competitions, and we were successful. We got a couple of prizes, and that sort of encouraged us to continue with that professionally. We were very excited about it. So we got our first job in Sioux City, Iowa, as a resident quartet of the symphony there. And there was a large educational component to our work there. We did a lot of cutting our teeth in that arena, and going out to elementary schools and middle schools and crafting different programs tailored to each different age range and each sort of level of experience with the instruments. So we spent a lot of time with that, and at the same time we were rehearsing like crazy in this little church that generously donated their space to us, and we fought our way through Bartok 4 and Brahms A minor and things like that. And we were very aware that while we were lucky to have a job, and you know, that was great, we were getting paid to do what we wanted to do, we still felt like we had a lot to learn, and we wanted to have more performance experience outside of where we were living. So we applied for the Aspen Music Festival Center for Quartet, Advanced Quartet Studies. And I think that was 2002 that we probably did I think it was January 2002. A freezing cold day in Chicago. We went to Roosevelt University. It's just blisteringly cold. And we played for Earl Carlis from the Juilliard Quartet there. And we'd never met him before. But anyway, we were fortunate to get a spot to go study there that summer. And that was just an amazing experience, because it was us plus two other quartets, great groups, and very inspiring to not only see them and have master classes with them, but to also see these other guest artists coming in to perform and learn from them. So that was definitely a hugely formative experience for us as the quartet, and a completely different world from what was happening the year round for us, you know, in our daily activities there, because we were literally just focusing on repertoire and building our chops. So we weren't doing anything else. So it was a very focused time, and it was a very special time in a very beautiful place. So it was great. So that we did that for two summers, 2003 and 4, I think. And oh, 2 and 3, was it? 2002 and 3, yeah. And then I think the other big educational thing for us around that time was the Carnegie Hall professional training workshops that we did a week with two other quartets of intensive work on the even-numbered Bartok string quartets, culminating in performance there at Weill Hall. And the Emerson Quartet was with the coaches for that, and so we saw them every day, and hours and hours of time together with them. So again, very intensive time, but just extremely inspiring. And ultimately, that led to us recording all of the Bartok string quartets. So definitely an important part of our journey there, too.
Yeah, I was just thinking both violinists in the Emerson studied with Oscar Shumsky, I believe, as did, I think, Roland Vamos that you studied with.
Mm.
Yeah. just legacy. It's always interesting to me, the lineage. So actually, you studied with some very famous teachers. Do you want to speak to any of that early education experience?
Sure. Well, I after I'd finished in England, I came over to the United States to study with Dorothy DeLay. Before the quartet, I went to Aspen on my own. So I studied with Dorothy DeLay and Masao Kawasaki. They sort of tag teamed, and that was a dream for me because I'd grown up listening to Itzhak Perlman. I just loved his playing, and you know, idolized him. So I thought, well, if I can get to see his teacher, then you know, maybe I'll start to sound like 1/10 of Itzhak Perlman. So. So that was very exciting to me to study with them. And after a while, I then moved to Ohio, and I was in Oberlin for a while. So that's where I met the Vamoses, Mr. and Mrs. Vamos there. And that's what ultimately led me to Kent State University. Mm-hmm. It's a long story, which I don't think your listeners probably want to know, but that it was from Oberlin to Kent State, and then, mm-hmm. boom, a Euclid Quartet happened. So.
The Vamoses are famous kind of because they're a couple that kind of tag team taught. How did that work? Did they alternate? Was there a system?
I alternated weeks with them, and okay. I would do primarily technical work with Mr. Vamos. So I went through all the Sif Chicks, all the Paganini Caprices, just a lot of notes with him, and a lot of drier things. Too, but the Paganinis were definitely fun. We were able to have a little bit of musical fun with that. Mrs. Vamos is a very emotive teacher, I would say, and so I'll always remember when she would demo, she couldn't help herself, but she'd sing along at the same time as well. She's just so much coming out all the time. So that, you know, I did primarily repertoire with her, and a bunch of pieces. I, for some reason, Prokofiev one is jumping to mind, and Bach Chacon as well. I remember working on that with her too. But they were really complimentary. They didn't sort of get in each other's way at all. I think it worked nicely that I didn't take the same stuff to each one of them. You know, I was doing these two things concurrently.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned Masao Kawasaki because his son, Yosuke, is our concertmaster who was also featured on this podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. He scared me. Not his son. Masao was, I remember him telling me once, your violin playing sounds like you have a cold. I'm like, oh, no. Yeah, he was definitely a little drier than Mrs. Vamos, let's put it that way. But great. I mean, he's, straight to the point and always knew exactly what needed to be done to get it sounding better.
And did you have that experience with Dorothy DeLay that you'd have to wait in the hallway for your lesson?
Yeah. I remember being sitting in Juilliard for hours there. And then one day it was terrible because Sarah Chang was right before me. I thought, come on, really? I've got to go and follow Sarah Chang? That's not fair. You know. So I think I even said something to that effect when I came into the room. I said, okay, I know who you've just been speaking to and working with. Sorry, I'll do my best. You know. I ain't Sarah Chang.
So another piece I was hoping to feature on this episode is the Shostakovich Polka. You guys play it so well. It's such a cool piece. Would any of you like to speak to that?
Yeah, the Shostakovich Polka is one of the goofiest things that we've ever done. It's a very funny piece to begin with, just looking at the notation even. It's just very strange and, it's got like that sort of Shostakovich, you know, sardonic sort of sensibility, but then it also has just pure slapstick in it, which is very fun. We found some things, perhaps are not in the score. Like, we had this idea to make the violins sound like, they started playing a month ago, at a certain point, had a lot of fun with that. Yeah, it's just that one was a real blast to put together, especially because it, you know, comes together pretty quick. But it was, it, you know, it's a fairly simple piece to put together, and then there's so much that you can do with it to make it even sillier than it is to begin with.
Interesting. It doesn't sound easy to put together. I mean, you guys, there's so much life to it, to your performance.
I think if you were to like play it with a metronome and, you know, just learn the notes, I don't think it would be, you know, certainly compared to the Wolf Italian Serenade, you know, it's a lot less to deal with. But I think we did a lot of like jarring tempo changes and things that are not written in there just to try to amp up the character changes. So I know the bit that Justin was talking about with the violins, that we're written in minor seconds, so it already sounds bad intentionally, but then we played with no bow, and then we have this idea that it would be the story of this miraculous student that with an 8-bar suddenly learned how to do spiccato. So if you listen carefully, you hear that it develops. Exponentially gets better. Like, it starts sounding awful, and then we learn as we go. So we had fun with that silly story in the piece there. But yeah.
I could hear that for sure.
This polka is from Dmitri Shostakovich's score to the ballet The Golden Age.
Aviva, if you could talk to the experience of joining an established string quartet and what that audition process was like.
Sure. So I joined the quartet. This is my third year. And I don't know, maybe unlike Jamie, quartet was kind of like what I wanted for basically, as long as I can really remember wanting music to be a part of my life, I did a lot of it growing up as well. And so I've always kind of been on the hunt for the job I have now. So to primarily be doing string quartet and integrating, especially university teaching, that's been great. So when the job posting opened up, well, talk about lineage. I shared the mentor of the Emerson Quartet when I did my doctorate. I was at Stony Brook, so I was working with Phil Setzer and the whole Emerson Quartet very regularly. I was in a quartet there. I continued in a different string quartet out in Pittsburgh before joining this group, so I was really kind of gunning for that. So Phil Setzer, you know, encouraged me, and maybe, yeah, just like gave my name. And so I applied to audition. And it's interesting, especially because the university is kind of overseeing the search. It's not just like quartet picks and you're good to go. The audition process involved quartet, just jumping in and rehearsing together. They told me a couple pieces to prepare, both first and second violin parts. Then I also did some teaching demonstration stuff, some interview stuff. So I think it's really like the whole package. It's, as Justin said earlier, versatility is really important. So one of the things that I think is especially really important for a university like Indiana University South Bend is the community aspect. Like, it is designed as a commuter school for this area. So as part of our job, we are very much integrated in the community and in this area. So that was something that I think brought to the table in my interview as well, as something that I had done a lot of previously, both as an ensemble member, but just as a person. so that was something that I introduced. But yeah, it's always really fun, you know, when you play with a certain set of people for an extended period of time, you really start to learn their mannerisms, you kind of can integrate. And so as soon as it's a different set of three people who've learned, you know, each other's mannerisms, it's a fun little, like, on-the-go puzzle. And, you know, different personalities. So, yeah, I mean, I had a great time at the audition, however nerve-wracking it was. Yeah, it's an interesting beast, I must say.
What are your most effective tools, Aviva, for dealing with nerves?
Oh, gosh. Well, you will often find me jumping around backstage. Meditation has been a really important part of my life for the past few years. That's something that I kind of do very regularly. So incorporating breath work and breathing beforehand. I get really cold all the time. So before performances is really tough for me. But yeah, trying to find ways to stay warm. The jumping up and down is part of that. If there's a little more space, you know, maybe like doing a little dance. Nerves are constantly a part of things, but I've found that we are performing a lot in all sorts of different circumstances, and just the practice of performing is so helpful. The seventh time you play the same piece, the nerves definitely go down. And I think the more comfortable I get in, you know, different spaces and with different repertoire, that helps. So breathing, jumping around, dancing, and playing the same things a bunch of times, keys to success.
I was thinking about how, you know, as an orchestral musician, when we do auditions, you know, it's all completely screened now, and of course there's no interview. We don't even look at CVs. I mean, it's just how you play. You have those few minutes to prove yourself. It's so different in the chamber music world.
It is, yeah. I think there's nothing more brutal than an orchestra auditions. For it, it's just I can't think of anything else in life in any other field that's quite like it. It's a very impersonal way of presenting something that has been your whole life very personal. It's a very strange thing. And, you know, how much of your personality do you let show, you know, or do you just want to get it right? Or do you dare show a little bit of your ideas on the things, you know? So it's a curious thing for sure. And certainly in terms of quartet auditions, it's a very different mindset from that, you know, because you are interested in not only how well somebody plays, but the personality of that newcomer, how they're going to work with you. Can you see yourself being in the same room hours and hours a day, every day, you know? Does it feel like it's going to work? And also, you know, how's that personality going to come across to others as well? You know, do you have a real live wire that's going to make you seem more sparkly, or do they seem, you know? So, yeah, the personality, I think, is something that is very much assessed in a chamber music audition, and something that is pretty much an unknown in the orchestral audition setting. Yeah.
Now, Jameson, you also conduct.
I do, yeah. Not very well, but...
how is that different in terms of being more of a boss?
Well, I'm the boss in the quartet.
In the quartet. Yeah.
No, I conduct primarily students. You know, it's mostly that. So, you know, there's a natural sort of hierarchy built into it anyway. But I certainly try to establish a feel in the room where I'm open to suggestion. And, you know, while I will try to focus everything and teach, I certainly don't think I'm inflexible or things like that. So it's I don't actually feel that far removed as a conductor from I do in chamber music, really. I mean, even physically, you know, I think of the way I'll give an upbeat with a baton is very much how I, you know, try to do it with a bow or the scroll or whatever. So I'm cannot say I consciously change, other than the fact that students, you know, as opposed to colleagues, there's a slightly different way of speaking than there, but it's not fundamentally different to me by any means.
Is there frustration with not being able to make the sound? You know what I mean?
No, I make plenty of sound the rest of the time. So. No, I've never thought of that, actually, no. I sometimes get frustrated with what I'm hearing, and someone's like, give me that violin. No, more like this, you know. But no, I generally, I like conducting very much. We just did the local opera company here. We just did a production of The Merry Widow, and it's really a fun experience for me to, especially that, where, you know, with the theatrical element as well, you know, it's quite different, and... just gets different juices going, I guess.
And having played the Haydn concerto with Haydn C major with the IUSB orchestra last semester, can confirm the vibe that Jamie is talking about. He does create that.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
I have an interesting experience about that idea of conducting without hearing what you're conducting. I actually had to learn conducting as well from our previous job in Sioux City, Iowa. Both Jamie and I had to conduct a youth orchestra. But during COVID, for a chamber music project, I had this idea to conduct the Adagietto from Mahler Symphony No. 5 on my own as I was whistling the entire movement. So I videotaped myself conducting in front of the camera, whistling the entire thing. And then I had this idea to put together a group of students and myself following myself conducting and turn that conducting into actual music. I had everybody record themselves watching me conduct, including myself. It was pretty interesting. And then the final pro is like, wow, that's what I thought about in the moment when I conducted that one Saturday morning. I woke up at 8 a.m. I just did it for fun. I was like, I would have done it differently, but since I did it, it was just interesting, you know, like timing what came in my mind at that moment, and hearing that what came in my mind at that morning made music. It was very interesting.
Luis, I'm trying to understand. You were whistling the viola part?
No, I was whistling the entire part, like the melodies. Okay. I like to whistle myself. So something my colleagues make fun of me about. Yeah, because I used to, I even considered entering a whistling competition. I was very serious about that. years ago, I had a tooth broken. And then my whistling was actually pretty good until I decided to cover that tooth, and then it was no longer good. I would like think about the entire piece, the melodic line, and then I'll whistle the whole thing.
Okay.
That's what I did.
Before we leave this, can you talk to the world of international whistling competitions? I'm kind of curious about this.
I actually don't know much about it. You know, there was a competition back in, when I came to the United States, it was many years ago. And as I say, that was back when I could whistle very well. But there is such a thing. If you actually do a search on whistling competition, there are amazing people there that can do amazing things. And one of the weird thing that I could do that I can't anymore is like with that hole in my tooth, I could do articulations, which I can't do anymore. So I remember Ruslan and Luzmila from Glinka. And it's very fast, you know, very virtuosic. So, and I could do like continuous breathing, just like an oboist could be to do. So I could like whistle inwards as well as outwards. So continuously as I was doing the articulation. I mean, I don't know how I was able to do that, but I can't anymore.
That's very cool. There's a video on YouTube, 4 for Tango, the Piazzolla, which is also in the album. Could we use some of that in this episode so people can see you play? Do any of you want to talk about that piece?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's, I would say, probably the most fun piece on the album. It's a tango, I guess. But I think the unique aspect of it is what we get to do with our instruments. I don't think any of the other pieces quite have this. So Piazzolla tries to get some effects that imitate a tango band, but he only has our instruments to work with. So he writes in things like drum or whip. So we have these little effects that kind of achieve tango band-like things using just our string instruments. So the viola has figured out how to do this drum effect very well. So it's just, we also have something like called sandpaper, so it gets this kind of like scratchy percussive instrument. So it's definitely a fun one. There's the tango bass, but there's also all of the effects that bring it to beyond the string quartet kind of sound world. So it's a fun one.
Wonderful, thanks. This performance of Astor Piazzolla's 4 for Tango is from a live video of a performance at Indiana University South Bend by the Euclid Quartet. If you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, the original video is linked in the description, and their other recording of this is part of their album, Brev.
Thank you.
Now, you guys recorded, I think your first recording was Hugo Cowder's string quartet.
Yep. That actually was an interesting situation. So the Hugo Cowder Society put together competitions every year. I don't think they do that anymore. But the first competition they did was the string quartet competition to honor the music of the composer Hugo Cowder, who was a Jewish composer living in Vienna, and beautiful music that he composed. But, you know, at the time the Nazis took over Vienna, he was able to escape and migrated to the United States. So the foundation, so the society was founded in New Haven, Connecticut, the family of the composer. And at the time of the competition, the son of the composer was alive. And then, so we entered the competition. So you're supposed to perform a piece of the composer plus something else. So we chose Quartet Number 2 of the by Hugo Cowder, and we actually won the first prize of that competition. And the son of the composer talked to me after the competition, and he told me that actually the composer was a violist himself, and then he. I noticed immediately it's just the connection of the viola part. I mean, it's so beautifully written for the viola, and he was at a, he had an affinity with my playing. It was very beautiful talking to him. But anyway, he invited me to be a member of the society, the Hugo Cowder Society, and as part of that relationship, a suggestion came out to do a recording of at least. I don't know exactly what they wanted. We decided to do four quartets. The first four quartets of Hugo Cowder, we actually made a proposal to the society, and they actually covered the expenses of that. So we recorded that. This was early years of the quartet, actually. You know, we were still living in Sioux City, Iowa. So, yeah, our very first CD.
Mm-hmm. Louise, did you start on violin like a lot of violists, or right away on viola?
Yes and no. I wanted piano, actually. I was interested in being a pianist. My sister was a very committed pianist. We only had a piano in my house, and she played 7 hours, 8 hours, you know, a day. So my mom was like, you know, I don't think you should play piano. She's not going to let you practice. So pick something else. And I was like, I don't know. And my sister took me to recitals, you know, like she took me to a tuba recital. And I was like, no. bassoon recital, flute. And I was just not interested. I was more into sports at the time. I was just like, you know, this isn't going to work. I just like playing soccer. This is my thing. I mean, we have my sister to be a musician in the family. Let's keep her like that. But then, you know, like I started getting interested in music more and more. And then actually my sister was my inspiration. That's why I started thinking about piano being my instrument. But then eventually she took me to a recital violin. And I was like, oh, I do like the violin. All right. So my parents bought me a violin. And at the time, you know, there wasn't a teacher to teach me. So there was a person who traveled from far and was constantly canceling lessons, and I got very frustrated. So eventually my parents asked, well, what could he be working on now? Well, before his first lesson. And he said, well, buy him the Suzuki book, number one. And then I sort of taught myself out of the pictures of the Suzuki book, you know, watching the postures and all that. So for a month or a little over a month, I just self-taught from the Suzuki book. And eventually I went to my first lesson. I was already 14 years old, pretty grown up. And my teacher would say, you know, you should consider playing the viola. You know, you're a tall guy, you know, the instrument, full-size violin looks pretty small on you. I think you should consider playing the viola. And there you go. I mean, within weeks, I was switched to viola. So my extent as a violinist was very short. So, mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Justin, you also joined the quartet. You're the most recent member. So what was your experience like, you know, switching groups? And
so my audition experience was pretty similar to what Aviva described. My experience, the reason that I applied for the job was... y'all remember 2020. right as the pandemic hit, two of my colleagues in my old group, who were originally from Spain, they decided to move home to be with family and to, you know, create lives over there. You know, my quartet throughout the pandemic, my old group, we basically were, you know, half a quartet. You know, that led me to think about the future and to, you know, look for stability and, you know, seeing an opening in a quartet that has had a 25-year career. And, you know, that is pretty much the definition of stability within this very narrow field. That was something that was very attractive to me. And, you know, coming out and playing with these guys was super fun. You know, it was the right moment and the right opportunity.
Yeah. Like the Schubert Quartetsatz, it's just so great. And of course, Schubert is such an important composer for quartets. Would that be a good idea to include a little bit of that?
Yeah, right.
Jamie, do you want to talk to Schubert and what it means as a quartet player?
Yeah,
music?
Sure. I mean, I think Schubert's incredibly difficult to play. Similar to Beethoven, it just doesn't feel great a lot of the time. I specifically remember that this piece, we learned this early on in the quartet days, and I remember getting very frustrated with the dynamics, because everything is like piano, pianissimo, triple B. It's like, well, can we ever actually play anything? So, I mean, you sort of, I guess, as you spend more time with things, you sort of make your peace with that, and you learn that, well, you know, you've got this range, and, you know, you present it here, there, or whatever, but it's more about colors and, you know, the feel of things rather than a decibel level. So when we first learned it, I didn't necessarily think quite as well in those terms as I do now. But I think what's, you know, who knows what the rest of the piece was going to be like. But what I love about it is that it really does work beautifully on its own, because it's got such a range of moods in it. It starts with a very sort of energetic and somewhat mysterious quality to it, with a very fast build to a very dramatic Neapolitan moment. And then quickly then we get into this very singing, song-like Schubert melodies that we all know and love. And it just weaves in and out of that. And the accompanimental textures are so busy in this piece as well. I think that's very interesting texturally, that you've got this sort of slow soaring melody, and underneath there's so much bubbling activity there. So it's one of the things on our recording that I'm most proud of, because I think that I feel that we've managed to accomplish those different textures pretty well on that. And I think it fits our sounds well, that piece. So I enjoy playing it, even though it still scares me.
You're about to hear a short excerpt from Franz Schubert's Quartettsatz, which is a one-movement piece that is the only surviving movement of his uncompleted 12th string quartet. Wonderful, thanks. When you guys coach young quartets or student quartets at the university, what kinds of things did you find they have the most trouble learning?
Well, it feels like after a while you do it day in and day out as a professional quartet, you sort of forget about some of the things that you take certain things for granted. And it's always surprising to me how cueing has to be taught. It's just, and again, as a conductor, I just do a lot of that kind of thing anyway. But to actually have to verbalize what it means to cue somebody, and what is the information you are trying to impart with that gesture, so that's a challenge. And then some people just physically don't do that well. Some people it's very natural. I teach conducting class here at the university, and I see that a lot. Like some people, it goes, and others, it's just the coordination of the physical motions is very difficult. So that, I would say that's probably the thing that I always, I'm a little taken back by with a group that is just not naturally getting that, and having to talk through it and have them try different things so they find a physical language that makes sense for the music they're about to play is always interesting.
Do any of you find with students that they sometimes play early to their own cue or late to their own cue? You know what I mean by that?
We still do.
I think also going back to like the very beginning of what we were talking about today, like the infrastructure of chamber music and like how it happens for kids, I think one of the things that I feel like we have to deal with a lot is chamber music as sort of an afterthought, in music education. You know, generally, like, kids get lessons and play in orchestra when they're, like, serious about their instrument, right? And I think that chamber music often is sort of, like, tacked on as just, like, something to do. And I think that what that sometimes leads to is, like, not really knowing the part, not really knowing the score, and kind of just playing, you know? And I think it's hard to impress upon people, like young people who are already busy with tons and tons of stuff, the importance of like treating this with the importance that we think it deserves. and I think that's actually like one of the hardest things I think to deal with, because, you know, it is something that we devote our lives to and we think that it deserves that kind of treatment, that kind of importance. And you know, that's just not true for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I was in university, it was always such a struggle to get people to actually rehearse between the coachings, because there was just so much, you know, so much pressure to do everything else, and of course practice for your teacher, but it's all about the rehearsing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You guys did a cool piece, did Anna Klein write it for you, the Concerto for String Quartet and Orchestra?
Yes, that was... very recently, in October, we did the premiere, and it was the Fischhoff National Chamber Music Association's 50th anniversary year, and so they wanted to commemorate it by commissioning a piece which spoke to their mission. So they wanted to involve, obviously, chamber music, have a representation there, but also community organizations, including the local symphony, South Bend Symphony. So we were fortunate that Anna Klein was able to write this piece for us. So it's a string quartet concerto, a four-movement concerto. And it was based on the Four Seasons, not in the same order as the Vivaldi. And it was really cool. Like, texturally, it's a very interesting piece, that the way she's works at the combination of the quartet or with the orchestra or the quartet standing in relief. It was a really fun thing to dive into, and luckily she was able to come out to the premiere as well, so she got to work with us a little bit and listen to it, and a good time was had by all.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, if there's more repertoire like that, do you think it would help bring like symphony audiences into you know, chamber music concerts if they are not already?
That's a good question. I mean, it really doesn't feel like chamber music. I think that's the thing. You know, it's I think, you know, it might get audiences interested in the personalities of that group, but I don't think you'd have any sense of, oh, I like this, well, maybe I'd like a Mozart quartet. It just feels like quite a different animal to me. We did actually, the first half of that concert was just us alone, so maybe that concert functioned in the way you described it. I don't think that piece necessarily would.
So what kind of unconventional concerts do you do, or settings do you do as a quartet?
I would say largely it's been like collaborative things that aren't necessarily like, oh, a natural thing that you'd think about if you think of quartet. One thing is on my mind, because it's upcoming, is we're collaborating with a librarian who has an ongoing story time series program for young kids. So I've worked with her a couple of times on pairing different children's books with different pieces of music or excerpts from a certain composer to tell a certain story that's really, really bite size and you know, user-friendly for a four-year-old, but it still kind of gives you a sense of, oh, wait, people, you know, there is storytelling naturally involved when you are playing chamber music. So that's been really fun. Last year, there was well, the book came out a couple of years ago, but on the life of Florence Price. Mm-hmm. And the book was written by actually school-aged children. And so we kind of combined that book with a Dr. Seuss book on emotions with the music of Florence Price and kind of integrated that. And so this was in this storytelling space with like the cute carpet and the kids sitting on the letters. And so that was really fun. And we're going to do another one in 2 weeks, and so that will be more about dancing and what kinds of forms dancing will take, and we'll use not just one composer's music, but so that'll be another window of like giraffes can't dance. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it invites kids to feel like they can dance, they can play music. If one piece doesn't speak to them, another piece might. So that's been fun. We've also done like a name that tune kind of a thing that gets into the video game world at the, this was also the library, but a different kind of cross section of the library's goers. So we did like a kind of trivia style little playing of excerpts in this like kind of tech space of the library, this Studio 304. So those have been really fun.
Were you playing video game music?
We were, yes. Justin, I'm sure, can talk a lot about video games, but he put together some arrangements for us so we could use those. And, you know, some of them were obvious and some of them really catered to the you really have to love video games to recognize this particular tune and this particular, like, I don't know, scene of a game. It got really specific.
Luis, you had something you were going to say.
Yeah, I just remember one of the reasons. Well, okay, so when we learn about the Anna Klein project, we wanted to book something by Anna Klein in one of our quartet concerts at IUSB, and then we put a piece by her that it's with electronic music. And that was very difficult to do, actually, playing along with a recording and being mic'd. That was very unusual for us. There was a whole preparation that was to be done, you know, with the microphone setting and all that stuff, the sound of the quartet. All the projects that we've done, actually, a few years ago, we did a concerto for Kyoto and quartet. It wasn't a concerto, but it was I don't know if Jamie remembers, but it's a piece for quartet in Kyoto, a Japanese Kyoto. And it was played by a very famous Kyoto player from Japan. That was very cool. And also another very interesting project that we did through the Carnegie Hall relationship after the thing we did with the Emerson Quartet, we were asked to go back to New York to do a piece which was written for children. It's a story that we will play the music of the story. So as the kids were watching a video of the story, we were actually the music as we were playing. So a little bit like old times movie theater, you know, with the organ playing and silent movies. So that was really difficult to do, to try to, you know, coordinate exactly with what was happening up in the screen. So that's very unusual.
Yeah. I mean, we do that as an orchestra, but we depend on the conductor. How did this work in the quartet?
We did not have a conductor, so we had to really be very attentive of what was happening. But obviously there are two members of the quartet were completely giving the back to it. So those who were more able to, like Jamie, for instance, was able to watch, being the sort of the cueer, like cueing the quartet as whatever's happening. So he was constantly watching up there what was happening.
I forget, Justin, in your quartet, do you sit with the cello on the outside or inside?
So I grew up sitting on the inside, and that was always my preference for a long time. With my old group, with the Spaniards, you know, they had a more European sensibility, and so I sat on the outside there, and I grew to understand that and, like, you know, have a way of doing things that I think worked. And now we're doing that here as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it does kind of feel good to sit on the inside in the sense that you're facing outwards and you can feel like you're projecting more directly. I at the risk of being hubristic or whatever, I believe that I have a large enough sound that I can sit on the outside and I don't have to worry about projecting directly at the audience in that way. I'm kind of fine with either way. And, when we were talking, when I first joined the group, we brought that up, and I'm fine with either way. And I think Luis wanted to try it, sitting on the inside, so that, you know, the classic problem of viola sitting on the outside is that you always have to be doing that. And we wanted to try to do that a little bit less. And I think, you know, we're feeling good with it.
Yeah.
For now.
I always prefer having the cellist on the outside, because it seems to me the second violin and viola, it makes so much sense to be close to each other. And I never understood why the violist has to be twisting. And the cello is such a big instrument. But so many cellists I've played with are like, no, I sit on the inside. That's the way it goes. And I think it's this projection idea. I'm never quite clear on this, but it's amazing what a difference just a foot can make, right? In the whole, your emotions of what's going on. And
yeah, I think, in the end, I don't think it makes an enormous difference in the sound. I think it does make a difference in the sound. I think the choice in my mind should come down to what makes the players feel most comfortable.
Yeah.
And in this case, it is cello on the outside.
So if you guys want to think about the rehearsal process, if someone wants to speak to that, just like when we have a new piece, let's say.
Well, I think that's probably changed a little bit over the years. I think we are now more a group that will try to speak less at first and not try to work out the minutiae of things from the get-go, but try to get more of a feel for the piece, a bigger picture than perhaps we used to. So first couple of rehearsals, if we're doing upbo and that person's doing downbo, okay, fine, we'll figure it out later. But it just, things like the overall architecture of the piece, the tempos, things like that, those are the sort of bigger picture things that we'll try to just let those naturally find their way into our system by just playing and not guessing so much, And then once you know it, then of course, then you start getting into the more detailed things of how do you really clean it up, But I think it's like, you're coming from a great height and then you're moving closer and closer and closer in towards this. So you're finally able to see. It's like on Google Earth when you can zoom out and then you can come back in. So we start in space and arrive at an upbo in great detail.
So Luis, I'm curious, we talked a little bit about what a string quartet career looks like. And looking back, if you guys had been able to be a quartet, maybe like the Emerson or one of these big names that was really relying on touring a lot, but that would have affected your personal life and the way, in terms of your day to day, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a compromise that you had to make. Particularly, if you're on the road so much of the time, if you have other commitments, like teaching particularly, that could be rescheduled. A lot of the time that could be done, like private lessons and things like that could be done. But there are classes, in-person classes, that you can't really do much with. So being on the road all the time, it's a little challenging when you have a teaching residency. There are a lot of, Justin was talking about that there's, that exist. There's a niche. There's groups that live purely off of just performing only. And it's very impressive. It's very impressive that they could do that.
So. But do you think it puts more pressure on the quartet interpersonally? Because it's so much all together.
Possibly. I would say I know that there are quartets that have had to take their time off when they're traveling, and they mm-hmm. do their own schedules, and you know, like they travel separate. I mean, we go back to the Guarneri Quartet, I guess, and then yeah. they just simply meet on the spot, just play the concert and goodbye. I don't see you until next concert. I mean, obviously, there's personal issues that go along with being 24/7 the whole time, you know, sharing time, you know, your personal space, and obviously that could be challenging. I guess imagine it hasn't happened to us. I mean, we seem to have a lot of fun when we're traveling.
But that's what I'm thinking, because you're not traveling all the time, so it's more special when you tour, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's true.
So,
yeah. So Aviva, maybe if you could reflect on your role as a teacher, what kind of things you think are most important to work on with your violin students?
That is very dependent on the student. I will say, in my capacity just generally teaching, because I don't only teach violin, especially at IUSB, listening to the specific needs and learning styles of students, one-on-one, sure, chamber groups, yes, classroom setting as well. That is very interesting, especially for me as someone who, like, I've done a lot of schooling, and so I know that my learning style is very different from a lot of the students who I do teach. So coming up with, like, creative ways and multiple ways of presenting information, whether it's a technical skill, whether it's music historical information, whether it's kind of like an ear training concept, whatever it is. So yeah, I think the finding multiple ways of expressing a concept that either it's like becoming ingrained and I don't even think about it, so I have to think about it, or something that I'm struggling with currently, and so it's really on my mind and I'm working through it, and then I kind of am also working through it with a student. Yeah, and then I think the other thing is, this probably goes for whether you're a student or not, the more invested you feel in something, the more committed and motivated you are to work on it. So finding ways, understanding what motivates students just in general, what is of interest to them, and finding ways to connect a concept you're trying to teach to that, I think goes a long way in just kind of getting everyone to the same level of desire of, you know, understanding something. So yeah, I think that goes to the listening side of things. Yeah.
Beautiful. Justin. Okay. So, what should we talk about? You know, maybe it'd be interesting just to reflect. We talked a little bit about, presenting concerts in different ways. And what do you think about that in terms of burnout as a performer, like just being able to think outside the box?
I think burnout is kind of a hard topic to discuss, not just because it's like sort of touchy, but also because it's different for different people. I think, you know, it is possible to get burnt out of just performing. It is possible to get burnt out of anything if you just do it a lot. So I do think that... finding variety in the types of performances that you do is an important thing, and not just to avoid burnout. I think you know, I said this before, but I really value versatility and like being able to go into any kind of performance situation or teaching situation or anything like that, and be able to do what you need to do. So I think, you know, of course, in terms, like, avoiding burnout is something that I think we all want to do. And I think that finding variety in the activities that you do is probably one of the best ways to do that. So in terms of performance, yeah, I do think it's important to find different venues, different audiences, different repertoire, just all different stuff, to just keep things fresh and also to kind of stretch yourself, so that you don't kind of get stuck in your particular mode of doing things.
Well, thanks so much for your perspectives. It was a thrill to meet you all today and to be able to do this with the whole quartet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.